Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a graduate student at BYU's English program, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I have written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
And we have a guest with us today. Kirsta, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Kirsta Christensen. I am a librarian at Brigham Young University's Harold Bailey Library. Specifically, I work in the cataloging department, and I work with our 21st century Latter-day Saint collection for special collections primarily. I see a lot of interesting materials produced about the church.
That's awesome. And today we are going to be talking about Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, which is a film about a widowed cleaning lady fulfilling her lifelong dream of owning a haute couture dress. I grew up with the 1992 version starring Angela Lansbury, but that's not available on streaming. And so we're going to be talking about the 2022 remake, which is available on Amazon Prime. But first, we're going to do our best book segment, where we each recommend one thing that we're watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is a short story collection that I just finished. It is called A Sense of Order by Jack Harrell. He is an LDS writer. I believe he teaches at BYU-Idaho. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. I had read one of his short stories a long time ago, Calling an Election, which is a creepy short story involving the Second Anointing. And it's very, very weird and ends strangely. And so I wondered what a whole collection of stories by the writer of that story would turn out to be. I found them to be very thought-provoking stories. I feel like the theme of the overall collection is considering our mortality and the limited nature of our mortal existence and what we choose to do with the limited amount of time that we're allowed to have. There's a great story in there called A Prophet's Story, which is about a general authority who wants to visit Walmart without his security detail, and it's pretty funny. So I recommend you pick up this quirky short story collection called A Sense of Order and Other Stories by Jack Harrell. Carl, what have you got for us today?
I don't have a lot to report on my new stuff. I can report that I have finished some of the stuff that I have mentioned before. I'm still working my way through the Chronicles of Narnia with my daughter. She had a hilarious Freudian slip the other day. We were talking about the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and I said, "Now you remember who the dragon is now, right?" Because it'd been a couple of days since we listened to it. And she said, "Oh yeah, it's Useless." And I was like, "Yes, absolutely. The name of that, yes, that character is Useless." That, anyway, Eustace, of course, for those of you who remember the books. Anyway, it was fun. I have finished The Wheel of Time season 2. I don't think we're going to do an episode about it like we did for season 1 in the podcast, but oh my gosh, sophomore season, so much better than the freshman outing. Light years better. I don't know where those actors and writers were the first season, but I'm glad they all showed up for the second season. And I also finished Ahsoka, which is, I don't know, man, to my mind, Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau are doing so much better at Star Wars than anything Kathleen Kennedy and Jay Abrams have been putting out. Watch your Star Wars on Disney Plus, guys. Don't go to the theaters anymore. That's all I can say about that. I have nothing new to report. Oh, I did watch a couple of movies for our next episode, but we'll get to that at the end of the show.
Awesome. And Kirsta, what have you got for us?
So I have an article. I actually read it a while ago, but it really fits in with the theme. So this is an article from Vogue magazine, and it's called Why Indigenous Beadwork is My Idea of Luxury by an author named Christian Allaire. And Christian Allaire is a writer and reporter for Vogue. He covers high fashion, everything. But he is Ojibwe and grew up on the Nipissing First Nation in Ontario, Canada. And so he grew up around a lot of handcrafted items such as beadwork and ribbon dresses and jingle dresses. And so in this short article that I was able to read without a subscription or anything, so hopefully it's available to everyone, he talks about growing up with a lot of traditional handicrafts and then coming to love fashion and high fashion and kind of reject those handicrafts. And then coming back around to appreciate them because of the love that was used to make them and how they relate to his community. And so it's a really interesting perspective from someone who is in the high fashion world but has come to value the stories and the provenance and the care with which handmade beadwork is made. So yeah, it was a really interesting article.
That does sound fascinating, and it really fits right into the theme of the show we're going to be talking about. So thank you for that recommendation. We'll have links to all of these on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. And if you buy any of them through these links, it helps support the podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and the beautiful in pop culture. And now we're going to move on to our main discussion of Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Okay, when I was looking for people to talk about this movie, Kirsta, you said this is one of your favorite movies. So tell me about why this is one of your favorite movies.
So I said that it was on my to-watch list, but I actually hadn't seen it before.
Oh,
so
that was someone else.
It was a pre-favorite movie. No, I'd heard good things about it. It had good reviews from critics. And I was aware of the Angela Lansbury version, but I never saw it. But I knew that it had been made in the past. So it was something I was actually looking for an excuse to watch. And then you were looking for people to record. And I was like, that would give me a chance to watch it. So yeah, it was an unexpected choice for a religious podcast. I didn't really know how that would go. But it is an absolute gem of a film and just has some really, really interesting things to say about personal relations and what we value in life. And so yeah, I'm really glad I got the chance to see it.
So that makes me the only person who had seen it when I proposed this podcast. And I had forgotten what it was about. So I got a little bit surprised. I got a little bit nervous. I was like, oh, wait, is this actually a good movie to do a podcast on? But having rewatched it, I was reassured because I think there are actually some very interesting moral themes in this movie. Carl, what did you think your first time watching this movie?
I loved it. I am so glad. I know the podcast was originally your brainchild, Liz, but I am glad that you are here keeping it. Because if I were in charge, it would just be like nerd culture on the apricot tree. All we would be doing would be like Wheel of Time and Ahsoka and that sort of stuff. But you pick these ones occasionally that are not something that I would go out of my way to see. My wife had watched this, and I am so glad that I watched this movie. It is a fantastic movie. A gem. That's a great word to describe it. Kirsta, I fully approve of that vocabulary choice. I was delighted the entire time. I watched the first 10 minutes and I was like, this is a good movie. This is a really good movie. I just liked all the things that it had to say about the things that we value and the goodness in everybody and how our relationships can change each other all for the better, I think, in this movie, with maybe one exception. And it was such a Christian movie in some important themes without being explicitly Jesus-centric. And I thought that was fantastic. And I loved the whole thing. Yeah, it was a great movie.
Yeah, I think it's unusual too. I think you can tell that it is a remake of an older movie. And then the movie is actually an adaptation of a novel, which was published in the 50s. In some ways, the story has some much older sensibility and it feels fresh because it's very different from the kinds of stories we're getting nowadays in Hollywood. And I noticed as I was watching it, it has maybe not as predictable of a storyline in terms of it doesn't follow the usual narrative arcs that we would expect. It's not about she gets the dress at the end and it's a triumph, or this guy falls in love with her and sweeps her off her feet, a Cinderella story. She's still a cleaning lady at the end. Nothing truly miraculous happens to her, and the plot beats are a little off of what the typical Hollywood formula would say. But on the other hand, it also feels very predictable. My son came in and watched the last 20 minutes of it with me, and at the point where, spoiler warning, she lends the dress to someone, he said, oh, she's going to ruin it, and then she'll get a new one. And I was like, okay, 13-year-old predicted the plot of the movie from seeing 5 minutes of it. So it's interesting because it has this balance of being so different from the typical plots we get and yet being predictable and comfortable and familiar at the same time.
I have to be honest, the ending to me was the part that I liked the least because it didn't end up with her, I'm going to use this term specifically, it didn't end up with Mrs. Harris having any kind of apotheosis because I felt like she deserved more than just about any other character I've seen in years. She was nice to everybody. She was kind. That drew everybody to be their best self around her. She has changed the world, literally the fashion world. This random cleaning lady from London And at the end, she gets a dance, and that's it. And I felt let down because I was so invested in her. I wanted her to get more than just, oh, that's the beat we hit. Of course, she runs off with the marquee or gets swept off her feet by the Irish gentleman. Just as a plot point, sure, we expect that. But I wanted that for her because she deserved that. And I felt cheated a little bit because she didn't get what I felt her moment of triumph should fully have been. She's such a good person. She deserves it.
I haven't read the book or seen any of the other versions, but I read somewhere that in the book, at least, she doesn't even get the second dress. The first dress gets ruined. She never gets to wear it. And then she ultimately decides that the experience was the important thing. She doesn't even get the dress. So I was at least grateful that she got a dress at the end, even if she doesn't get anything that's grand and life-changing. I was also worried as she started to charm all of the fancy, snobby Parisians. I was a little worried it would be an Emily in Paris situation where everyone just loves her for no reason. But I felt that what they appreciated about her was all the hard work that she had put into getting there. Unlike other people who were there because they could afford it, because they're wealthy and they took it for granted, she had clearly spent years, basically, because she's able to go because of her husband's pension. This is years worth of money for her. This isn't just something she can do multiple times a year. And so I felt that was a big part of why they were charmed by her. And then also because she is a seamstress. And so she really appreciates their work. And the people behind the scenes felt seen in a way that they didn't feel by the normal fashion set who were buying, shopping for Dior dresses.
Yeah, the ending is interesting. I feel like that she doesn't get the Cinderella ending. I would expect in a Hollywood movie, she would end up working for Dior or whatever. And she would help all the seamstresses to do something or become successful and leave her life as a cleaning lady and no longer be drab or whatever. But she doesn't. And even her being nice to people, it does get repaid with the dress at the end. So that's interesting that in the novel that doesn't happen. Because perhaps that's a more realistic ending because you can't be nice to people anticipating that they're going to be nice back to you because that's not always the case. There's something to be said for choosing to be kind to people because it's the right thing to do and not because you're expecting that good things will happen to you because of it. And in some way, besides the dress, everything else, her cleaning clients still take advantage of her and she decides, you know what? I'm being too nice to these people. I need to pull back from that. And that is an interesting contrast because she's been really nice to everyone in Paris. And then she comes back and her reward, I think, is that she has more self-respect and confidence. And she's realized which people in her life are actually worth continuing relationships with and which ones are not being real friends.
That's interesting because I'd taken the opposite view of, I think you're right about the people she comes home to, and especially the one lady who is her patron, who she cleans for. She just wanted to settle up because I'm leaving and quitting because you are a jerk to me. But even the young starlet who she cleans for takes advantage of her. Maybe not deliberately takes advantage of her, but gets the dress.
She's thoughtless.
She's very thoughtless, and this has a very negative effect on Mrs. Harris. But I do not think she went to Paris with the idea that she's going to be nice to all the seamstresses, Dior, so they can get her an extra dress. That's not her mindset, certainly. I don't think you were saying that necessarily. But she's just being a genuinely good person to everybody she contacts so much. And when they respond, she is nicer. And then it becomes a feedback loop, a self-perpetuating cycle of niceness where everybody becomes their best selves, except for, again, maybe that one noble back in England who never responds to all of her niceness with niceness. And so the relationship gets cut off. And so I was just so tickled by seeing everybody respond to someone who's just genuinely good and looks at everybody almost through Christ-like eyes. What's the phrase from section 121? When you follow all of these things that it outlines for how to exercise influence, meekness, patience, long-suffering, kindness, gentleness, love unfeigned, all that stuff, it says that your dominion will flow unto you without compulsory means. And I love that. If you are all these things, people will just want to hang out with you because you're awesome. And I think Mrs. Harris embodied that when she went to Paris.
Yeah, and even though Lady Dant, one of the people that she did cleaning for, was, I think, one of the few characters who really didn't have any kind of good side shown in the film, even then, that's where she first sees the Dior dress, and that's where she first gets the idea that she wants to do this. Even though Lady Dant is a jerk to her, and I think she's right to cut her off, she was still the means of giving her something to work towards and starting her on this journey towards this really interesting adventure.
Yeah, it is really interesting what the movie does to humanize almost everyone, even the nasty female boss at Dior, who you just hate the whole movie because she is so against Mrs. Harris and just treating her snobbishly, like you don't deserve to be here, and just finding every excuse to put something up in her way. Then at the end, she gets completely humanized. Like, we understand why she is the way she is. She is that way because that's how she was able to survive in a male-dominated industry, that she needed to be uptight and to keep things going so she could support her husband, who has trouble since the war. And so you just understand why people are the way they are. So many of these characters have flaws, but they're understandable and they work towards overcoming them. Like, after this conversation with Mrs. Harris, you can see that Madame Colbert is going to try to turn things around and try to work in this new, gentler fashion industry that has been invented by Mrs. Harris leading a strike. That was the one part of the movie that I thought was maybe a little unrealistic, is like, we're going to have a strike, and within 1 hour, we will solve the fashion industry's problems and pay all the workers better. And it's great.
To me, the one part where I had to suspend my disbelief a little bit was how she gets into Dior in the first place, just running up the stairs with the purse. Oh, miss, you dropped this. And then ends up at the fashion show just randomly. And I was like, okay, we'll let them have their plot armor for that. But then it was so enchanting to have her meet the Marquis and to have him invite her to come sit. Because I thought that was a delightful and very fun relationship that didn't end the way I thought it would.
Yeah, from the perspective of the storylines that we're familiar with in more recent cinema, you fully expect, oh my gosh, she's going to end up with the Marquis, like literally Cinderella with a new dress and someone who's unrecognizable. And then it's no, actually, he doesn't see you as an equal. He's fond of you, but a pet. And that's, he is kind to her, but he doesn't treat her as an equal. And that's hard. And I did love at the end, Jason Isaacs' character, Archie, he's overwhelmed with how she looks. But he also is very clear to say, but you've always been beautiful. It's just you have a spark now or a sparkle. And my read on him was that he was sweet on her from the beginning, but that she was just pining over her husband and not really open to that. I actually did have kind of a plot question. I wasn't really clear at the very beginning. Did she only just find out that her husband had died, or only just accepted it, or did they only just find his remains? I wasn't really clear on what had happened because clearly it had been several years, but I didn't really understand what that telegram was about, or if she just never had the nerve to open it, even though she knew full well what it said.
Yeah, it's not really clear.
I don't know how long she had the telegram. That's the question that is not answered. You don't know if she's been holding on to it for a decade, if she just received it. It seems to me the best reading would be that she had just received it in the recent past, because then that gentleman shows up that says, oh, by the way, you should have had a war widow's pension for 15 years now, so here's your cash check. Enjoy Paris. Like, thank you for your husband's service and all that sort of stuff. But no, it's not entirely clear in the movie if she's been holding onto this telegram since World War II, it's now the late 50s, or if she recently received it and just has not gotten up the courage to open it from the British War Department.
Maybe he was like missing in action, but they didn't confirm that he died for 10 years. I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked. Anyway.
Sure.
That was my guess, is that he's been missing in action for a while. And you could imagine that, like, back then it would take a while to do these kind of investigations and settle up everything from the war, like figure out where all these planes went, where all these people went. But yeah, it does seem like she's a little bit in denial at the beginning. I wanted to go back to talking about the Marquis because I feel like one of the main themes of this movie is about class. And it's not something that we necessarily think about as much in American culture as they do in British culture, but there's a barrier of class between people, which is why the Marquis can't see her as a real human being, because she is a cleaning lady. And so she reminds him of the cleaning lady when he was at school, and he can't see that she is a real woman that he could build a relationship with. And Mrs. Harris is exactly the opposite. She sees everybody as just a person. And she reaches out to Natasha when she's on the red carpet, is like, hi!
Yeah. Yeah.
And the accountant is like, don't do that. You can't do that. And she's like, it's just people.
And Natasha is so happy to see her, too, is perfectly willing to walk off the red and talk to her friends. Yeah. Well, and with the march, I think, yes, he didn't see her as an equal, but I think it also didn't even occur to him that he could have been leading her on, you know, which is kind of what Shane kind of Natasha thought and some other people. So, you know, even the idea that you could be giving someone the wrong impression, you have to see them as kind of your equal, or you have to, you know, see their perspective or be things from their point.
See, this is really interesting because I did not read their interactions at all the way the two of you did. And maybe that's just the American in me or the Mrs. Harris in me, that when he says, you remind me of Mrs. Mops, the reason is not because you're a cleaning lady. The reason is because Mrs. Mops was really nice to him because he was bullied the way Mrs. Harris is nice to him now. And she reads that as, oh, you just see me as a cleaning lady. I don't think that is the only way to read the things that he is saying to her. Although I do have to say, as far as taking me out of the movie, that actor plays a character in the Matrix movies, and once I figured out who it was, I could not see him as anything but the Merovingian, and I was like, oh dear, this
is not
helping.
How funny.
That was my trouble with Archie. I was like, Lucius Malfoy cannot be the romantic interest. This is not working for me.
I've seen Jason Isaacs in some other things, so I can see him as not just Lucius Malfoy, but yes, I can see that perspective too.
Difficulty of movies and reusing actors who've been in iconic roles, but
I was thinking of him as the captain from season one of Star Trek Discovery, Captain Lorca.
There you go. Also not a good leading man either.
I have a couple of versions of Jason Isaacs floating around in my head that helps me with that moment. But anyway, I just read the Marquis and her interactions very different. I don't know if he seemed to be formally courting her. I don't know what the rules for formally courting someone in 1950s France are, so I can't intelligently comment on that, but he seems genuinely hurt when she ran away, and yeah, he sends her the huge thing of flowers at the end, but I feel like that was a missed opportunity on her part because she misread something, but maybe I'm misreading what he was doing, and the two of you are correct. I don't know. I just read that very differently.
So Natasha, for sure, thought that he was romantically interested in her because she said something about, oh, you've made a conquest, and Mrs. Harris was like, oh no, that's ridiculous. I think the best case scenario for the Marquis is maybe that it was a fond friendship. I don't think he would have courted someone who reminded him of Mrs. Mops. That seems a bit far to me. And based on the portrait of his wife, it seems clear that she was glamorous and a socialite and probably from a noble family herself, or had enough beauty to make up for that. In my read, that was never on his radar. But yeah, it was, she had maybe gotten her hopes up based on what Natasha said, and then read his reaction to her as insulting.
And I think it's interesting overall, kind of the message about class, but also about money in this movie. Natasha is this star. She's a model. She's the face of Dior. She's going to red carpet events with actors and stuff. And what she really wants is a quiet life with an accountant where she can read philosophy.
And not just any philosophy, 1950s French existential philosophy. She wants to really get into it.
And that's a choice that she made. As just having to pick up some Foucault for one of my classes, I was like, okay, that's great for you. You do that. I would not make that choice, but cool. But implication being at money is not what makes a life of value. And sometimes it's worth sacrificing money to get a life of value, even if it means you live less comfortably. Mrs. Harris's life, as hard as it is, a joyful life. It's not like a grinding poverty of my life sucks. It's I can scrimp and save and make these sacrifices and do fun things. And I can go out on the weekends with my friend and hang out, and she has a good life and people like her, even though she is not getting after it and being an entrepreneur and starting her business and trying to climb the ladder. That's not the message of this movie.
I'm not even convinced that Natasha was making that much money. She was a model. She certainly had a glamorous looking life, but she may not have been paid very much. There's also a theme in fashion that a lot of people who are peripheral to it don't actually make that much money. And Madame Colbert lives in a pretty modest situation. And the accountant, Fauvel, yeah, like these people look very glamorous, but they might actually be in very modest situations and just be hanging around people who have a lot of money, but not necessarily paid a lot themselves. Yeah, although certainly having a job is more than having no job, because we don't know what she's doing by the end of it other than studying philosophy and going around on a moped, but she seems very happy.
But I think it ties into the philosophy that they do bring up. They bring up, how do you pronounce his name? Sartre. They bring up this concept of, are we what we do? Do we over-identify with what we do? And I think that's the message, that is your identity of hanging around with cool people and being in this glamorous industry and being exclusive, is that who you are, your job? And I think the movie comes down and says, no, this is not who you are. Who you are is how you treat other people, which Mrs. Harris does. And like you said, infects everybody with treating people decently and kindly.
This whole theme of treating people well so that they treat you well, I almost cried at the end of the movie, to be honest, when she comes down the stairs at the dance to see, you know, Archie and Vi down there, and they look up and see her coming down. Again, not an explicitly Christian movie, but I just felt like this is what's going to happen at the final judgment when we see some of these random schmucks that we ran into or interacted with online who were just good people, good saintly people, right? Elder Bednar's talk in conference a couple weeks ago was all about the undersung heroes of the people who just do the basic work of the church and how that is honorable and right, and God acknowledges that. And it's just as seen as building the kingdom as being the prophet or some high ranking, quote marks there for those of you not watching on YouTube, some high ranking calling in the church. But when we see them, right, what's the C.S. Lewis quote? As you probably know it, like, when we see these people, we will probably want to worship them because they will be so amazing. And that's what I felt was happening there at the end, because she was so Christ and brings that out in other people, that when she shows up there at the end, I'm like, yes, that is Mrs. Harris showing up in her full glory, the way God sees her as this genuinely saintly person. I loved it.
Yeah, and I love that there's like a sub-message there, too, that's similar to Elder Bednar's talk. There, when she gets to Paris, there's trash everywhere because all of the garbage collectors are on strike, right? And then later in the movie, all of the seamstresses go on strike. And similarly, her job as a cleaning lady, when she's not there, everything is going to chaos for these women who depend on her to organize their lives because they're a mess. And so there is a message about how the people who seem important and powerful are maybe not the most important and powerful, that our society does depend on the insignificant jobs that everyone overlooks, that there's these garbage collectors, and if they don't show up and do their job, the city gets pretty bad in a very short order, right? That every person's job matters just as much, or maybe even more, than the people who are visible, who are designing haute couture dresses, right? Like Mr. Dior.
Right. That's to get a little bit more into continental philosophy. Again, the things we don't notice are just part of our everyday experience. Like, you don't notice the doorknob until it breaks. Then you're like, oh, what's going on? You just reach out, grab the doorknob, turn it, walk through the door. Like, it barely even registers on your consciousness. But the moment it breaks, you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I got to go to the hardware store. I got to fix this. I got to do all this stuff. The people who clean your houses, the people who take out the trash, we just don't notice them. It's just, oh, I just put the stuff out. It's bin night, to quote Bluey, and we're going to put the stuff out, and it just magically disappears the next day. And if they don't magically make it disappear, pretty quickly, everybody starts to wonder, oh, wait a minute, we need to fix this somehow. We need to make sure that these, like when in New York City, the garbage men strike in like the early 90s or whatever, right? People realize how much they depended on. It's a good message.
I was talking with one of my coworkers a few months ago who works in our IT department, and he mentioned that they had something coming up where they had to do some kind of server upgrade or something, where they had to come in on the weekend because that's when the traffic was slower, and just completely switch something out and move something new in. And they would know if they were successful if nobody noticed. because the ideal was to have no discontinuation of service, no bumps, nothing like that. And they were. And this is something they have to do occasionally. But it really got me to thinking about the people whose jobs are such that if they do their job perfectly, you don't know. Because I would have had no idea this was happening if they hadn't told us. And thinking about people whose jobs are like that, thinking about the extent to which my work is like that, and then also trying to be more appreciative of people like that, because sometimes the fact that you notice nothing means a huge amount of people are working really hard. And how can I be more aware of that and be more appreciative and not just take that for granted or overlook it?
So I think it's interesting that this theme comes up in a movie that is ostensibly about buying a really ridiculously expensive dress. So that's an interesting thing to ask about this movie is, I think Katya put it in one of our questions in our show notes document. What do we value and why do we value it? Is haute couture inherently immoral to spend amount of money that could probably have fed Mrs. Harris for 6 months on one dress that she can never wear anywhere because it's too fancy? What are the moral implications of fashion and of buying things like this?
I was honestly surprised that I enjoyed this movie as much as I did, because I actually have very kind of negative knee-jerk reaction to fashion in general. And part of it's my personality, where I don't tend to be a kind of up-to-the-minute consumer of culture. And if a book's 10 years old, I might be finally getting around to reading it, in which case, if a fashion trend is 10 years old, then it's out of fashion and we can't wear it anymore, right? I always feel like, well, why not? Why can't we just wear something that we like instead of having to change all the time? And then growing up, for a variety of reasons, I ended up going to junior high and high school with a bunch of kids whose family had a lot more money than I did. And that was not always a pleasant experience. And so I just have always, for a very long time, had a very knee-jerk reaction against fashion and trendiness and things that are expensive. But then at the same time, into adulthood, I've made friends with people who enjoy fashion just as a means of self-expression. And so I've had to work my way back around to that, because I'm like, oh, you like fashion, but you're not like a mean girl who's judgmental. Like, how can you possibly like fashion if you're nice, right? And so I've had to examine some of my own assumptions about things and misconceptions, even though it's not something I'm ever going to be particularly interested in, that it doesn't have to be inherently bad or inherently mean, but certainly the way that the fashion industry promotes a certain type of body image and is very hard on people who aren't extraordinarily thin, especially on women, and the way that so many people work so hard and then get paid very small wages, and that all the glory goes to a few people who can get away with being really monstrous, and that fast fashion is its own kind of ethical issue. For sure, there are really difficult things. One of the things about this time period, at least, was that it really did take a couple dozen people, cutters and stitchers and designers, to make one of these dresses. And at least at this time period, I feel like you really were paying for that handmade luxury. That was reasonable given the labor costs. Whereas these days, if you have something cheap that has a fancy logo on it and then suddenly it costs five times as much, I'm more skeptical of that. But yeah, it's interesting to try to come around and appreciate fashion from another perspective that is a little more ethical and humane and isn't just about being mean and exclusive.
Yeah, I did not have any problem whatsoever with her wanting to go to Paris to buy a super expensive dress. Maybe this is a little unethical of me or whatever, and I may abuse this in my own life too much, but sometimes you just got to treat yourself. And this is like the ultimate treat yourself movie. I'm going to go to this random cleaning lady who just got her husband's pension all back paid for 14 years or whatever, is going to go to Paris and buy this awesome dress. You know what? Fine. You go, girl. Whatever. I believe that by the sweat of our brow, we shall eat bread all the days of our lives, but that doesn't mean we can't enjoy good things in life as well, whatever that might be. And there's good conversation to be had about how to do so ethically and sustainably and I don't know, whatever else. But if that is the only thing that we care about, I feel like we've lost something and we ought to go for some good things every once in a while. Go on a vacation, get a nice piece of art, wear something nice, get yourself a nice tie in my case, or a dress or something, right? I don't know. And just as a little point of pushback to something that Kirsta just said, I'm really happy that fashion isn't exclusively anymore about just skinny folks. I don't know if you've seen a lot of the models lately, but the Victoria's Secret Angels of 10 years ago are no longer the standard by which everybody is to measure themselves. And I think that is a great thing to do.
Yeah, I agree, though, that we have made a little bit of progress in terms of body image in the fashion industry. I have noticed some of the websites when you go shopping now will let you pick your size of model, which is nice to get a little bit more of a perspective on how it might look on you.
And just realism, because what the fashion models 10 years ago, I was reading an article about it back in the day that talked about how the average fashion model was like 6'2" and weighed 110 pounds. And it represents like 1-2% of the female population. And that's all you ever saw. And that's just stupid and unrealistic. And I'm glad we've at least taken, to my mind, some pretty good steps to fix that sort of overall culture around clothing and what we wear and how we display it to other people to decide if they want to purchase it or not.
It is interesting. That's not really a question in this movie when Mrs. Harris wants to buy this fancy dress. That's a normal thing for them to have dresses that fit. It's custom fitted, but I mean that the style fits her body type. But I think the interesting thing here is not necessarily just the treating yourself mentality, which valid. We all need some release in our lives. But that Mrs. Harris is buying it because she values the beauty, the aesthetic value of this thing, and that it is inherently valuable to her, and not because everybody around her is buying it and she's trying to keep up with them. Or this is trending on Instagram, so I'm going to buy a Stanley cup or whatever. These things that go trendy that we're buying because it's status symbol or it's something that everybody else has and we want to fit in. So I think there's a valid point of it's not necessarily the item itself that is moral or immoral to buy, but sometimes it's our motivations for buying it. If we're buying stuff to keep up with other people or to deal with stress in unhealthy ways, then maybe those are not good reasons to buy something, but buying something because we appreciate its beauty and craftsmanship and because we want to support people who make those things, those are a little bit more positive reasons outside of even ethical considerations. But considering why we're buying something is an interesting thought.
One thought that I just came up with, whenever we picture heaven, we always, at least in Latter-day Saint art, it's just a bunch of people in white robes. They're all nondescript clothing, 100%. And is that really what heaven's going to look like? Because I feel like on one end, yes, the thing that matters in heaven is who you are and what kind of person you have become and how closely you have followed the example of our Lord Jesus Christ. But if there's no three-piece suits in heaven, I feel like we might be missing out on something else also. I don't know. Maybe that is something that I'm just not 100% on board with, or maybe the artists in the LDS culture are not. I don't know who's right there, but will there be any kind of fashion in heaven? Good celestial fashion, in the sense of something that looks good, that makes the person look good, but that we don't have to keep up with the Joneses. Nothing will ever be trending in heaven on Instagram, because Instagram is telestial world, but will everybody just be wearing nondescript white robes? Feels like that ain't right either. I don't know.
And going back to your point, Liz, I think there's a difference between valuing something in a positive sense, we're attracted to it and we think it brings positive things to us, versus valuing something in a negative sense where we want to look down on people, we want to gatekeep, we want to feel better than other people or be exclusive or cut other people out. You can have two people who both like the same thing, but one person does it in a more positive way and one person does it in a kind of unhealthy or self-conscious sort of way where they're just trying to push other people away and feel better than other people instead of just appreciating things in a way that everyone can do.
Yeah. If there's any scripture that I would associate with this movie, it would be one that we read recently in Come Follow Me, that it brings down the wall of partition between us. That in this movie, the whole goal is to treat everyone as people and not gatekeep, like you said, not exclude people, but to treat everyone as human and make beauty accessible to everyone, that it's not kept away from people because they're poor. So I love this movie. It's so great. We haven't even talked about like how the movie looks. it is interesting that the color palette when she's a cleaning lady is drab, and then she shows up in Paris and in the high fashion, and you get that transformation kind of thing of the beautiful colors and just the attention to detail that you have in this high fashion world.
It feels very Wizard of Oz, leaving Kansas and going into Oz, just how it changes. And the lightness, the attitude of everybody around also shifts with that in interesting ways. Sometimes on the more arrogant side, but then when they go back to England again with Archie and with Violet, they're so full of joy, even though it's a much more aesthetically drab existence. But I know which group of friends I'd rather hang out with, the Marquis and Madame Avalon or Madame Colbert or Archie and Violet. Yeah, I'd rather hang out with the latter. It's gorgeous. The movie is just gorgeous.
I think it's interesting, this kind of obsession that we have with France and what it symbolizes in the American mind, how we stereotype them as either having it all together or being really snobby. I'm thinking about how French culture kind of was trending when I was a young mom. They had that Bringing Up Bébé book that was about how French parenting was like perfect. And why don't we Americans just learn from how the French people raise their children? They do it so intuitively. And there was that whole French women don't get fat, that they just eat the right way. And magically, they never have to think about their weight. And we have some sort of mystification about France in America. Almost the same kind of mystification that we have over Scandinavian culture and thinking that it's perfect when there's still people over there in those countries and they have problems just like us.
The grass would be greener on your side of the fence if you watered it more.
Exactly. Any final thoughts about this movie or anything we didn't get to? I guess we could talk about the cabaret scene. This was the one scene in the movie that made me like hesitate about like, why? Why is he taking this woman he just met to see dancing girls? Like, is this just a normal thing in French culture or what?
I can't intelligently comment on French culture in the 50s, but that did feel incredibly weird and very out of place to me. I just don't know why you would do that for a first date in any situation, in any culture. It just seems so weird. But then, of course, the model is there too on a date, hobnobbing with some Dior patron people. And I'm like, okay, I guess this is just the done thing, at least in this movie. It didn't need to be there. They could easily have cut it and it would have been fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's a question of, should it be there for the purposes of the movie or should it have been there for the purposes of the characters? For the characters, to me, it seemed like a high class playboy kind of attitude where I think there's a certain kind of stereotyping of trying to make certain parts of culture seem high class. Like I'm not really, and it's 1950s nudity. So it's actually very tame compared to a lot of things now.
Not actual nudity by our definition of the word today.
Yes. But yeah, I think it's an attempt to class up a kind of seedy situation. It's not my vibe, but I also think maybe it's true to life for what the Marquis and the investors in Dior would have been doing. And the women just have to put up with it. And then whether or not it should have been in the movie is a different artistic choice. But yeah, certainly in terms of actual nudity, it's like a modest bikini kind of situation. But yeah, I would not have been happy there in the 1950s, no matter who I was with.
It was just weird to me. I was like, all right, whatever. And maybe that's our first hint that this is not a date, but could be the subtle message there. Some of the commentary by Mrs. Harris is hilarious, though.
That's true.
That woman looks like my aunt from behind. Oh, okay.
That's true.
Okay, I don't want to know the story behind that.
Hey, the movie is rated PG. Take that into account. That's just so interesting to me. I don't know if I would have bumped that up to 13 just because of that one scene, but I don't know. Just be aware that scene exists. I would definitely call that parental guidance for kids under 13.
So exercise your guidance as a parent.
Absolutely.
Then I guess that leads us right into our rating segment. We're already talking about the content. That is really the only content I feel in this movie. And it's just so dumb that it's there from my perspective. Like, why did you put this here? So we rate the content of the movie cleaning versus objectionable material on a scale from celestial, terrestrial, telestial, outer darkness. Is that enough to bump it off the celestial scale for you guys? What do you think?
It's funny. Some of the language in kind of the traffic jam the way they translate it, I think, is a little milder than the actual language that they use. If you know any French swear words, that also might bump it down from celestial. Not all of those words were in my vocabulary, but a couple of them were. And strong language is really hard to understand across languages anyway, but I did look up one of the words in Wiktionary. And no, they said this is vulgar and offensive. So they're translating it as idiot, which is not nearly that strong in English. So I would bump it down to terrestrial, but a fairly wholesome terrestrial. How's that?
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go with terrestrial myself just because of that one scene. I don't know enough French swear words to intelligently comment on that part of it. But the cabaret scene, it absolutely would have been celestial. And now that we're discussing it and I'm thinking through it again, I'm annoyed that they put it there because everything else in this movie deserves a celestial rating. And they just, I don't know. They shouldn't have put it in. I'm sorry. A lot of ways you could have done that scene that didn't involve that, and you should have picked one of those.
It literally could have been any other form of entertainment. I don't know. Like, where's our violin trio or something, or opera, or I don't know. Yeah, I would give this terrestrial plus, celestial minus. Good candidate for VidAngel because you're not going to miss much. And then you can watch it with the whole family, and it's like a really good movie for that. So there you go. Our next rating is for artistic merit. We rate on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls for the skillful and effective use of craft. Did the movie achieve what it was trying to do? Is it a good example in its genre? Carly, what do you think on a popcorn ball scale?
It's an interesting question of what genre is this? Because it's such a unique movie that hits on so many interesting themes about class in the strict sense of not just the way we Americans think of upper class as people who make more money, but no, this guy has a title. He is a marquis. He's not going to date the cleaning lady issue. But then rich and poor comes into it, the way we treat people, right? There's the one line where they say they're the rich. We just have to accommodate all of their desires. These sorts of issues get brought up in such good ways. But it's such a triumph to me that we like virtually everybody, again, with perhaps the exception of Lady Dant, but everybody else is delightful or gets brought along to be delightful. And like I said, when she comes down the stairs there at the very end, I almost cried because I just like, oh, she deserves this moment. She's such a good person. Everybody deserves to see her the way she really is. And I'm just going to give it 5.
I think I would give it a 4. I think it nailed exactly what it was trying to do. I just don't think what it was trying to do is the very heaviest lift ever. And before I was on this cast, I listened to some of your back episodes to get a feel for the structure. The episodes I listened to was Arrival, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris is no Arrival. Again, I think it nailed what it was trying to do. It's kind of a fable. It actually reminds me a lot of the film Dave, the Kevin Kline film. Or maybe that's a slightly different scale than what you're talking about.
You brought up the question of genre, Carl, and now I'm thinking about genre because I feel like this film was marketed as if it was a chick flick. But it doesn't have the plot of a chick flick because it's not a romance kind of thing. It's almost like Devil Wears Prada, but for old cleaning lady in Paris. And she's nice instead of mean.
Is Fish Out of Water a genre? Because Kirsten brought up Dave. I think that's a good example of person plucked from their element and put into some different element to see what happens. And in Devil Wears Prada, like, that's a good example.
That's the same thing.
Yeah, of how it changes her and how she kind of changes them. And Dave is the same sort of thing where he becomes president in this weird way and affects these changes in him and in the other people around him. I don't know. Is Fish Out of Water a genre?
I'm also thinking of good person making good choices as a genre. Is that a genre of movie? Because I'm thinking of Dan in Real Life, where the main character is just a decent human being and is in an awkward situation and then makes good choices and things work out. And
or Annie.
Yeah, I don't know. It does such a good job being what it wants to be, but you're right that it's not amazing cinema.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say a self-actualization genre or a discovering who you are. Almost call it a coming of age, but maybe you come of age in your 50s. That's fine.
And Mrs. Harris is so focused outward. She doesn't, as a person, change a lot over the course of the movie, which is another, like, why this doesn't feel like a Hollywood movie. The only change she makes in her life is that now she is not going to be a doormat for a couple of her cleaning clients. But other than that, she's still the same great person who she was all along, which Archie recognizes. She always was a great person. So I think I'll give it a 4 just to acknowledge that it is a quieter movie. But I can't think of anything that I would have done better except for remove the cabaret scene.
I still think she should have ended up with Archie or the Marquess, but whatever.
It wasn't the point of the movie, and I think it might have been a distraction and made us think that it was a romance movie. But yeah.
You're not wrong either.
Yeah. Okay, and our final rating is for gospel connections and morally edifying messages on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots. I have to say, I would put this at 5. I just feel like the whole movie is a lesson on treating people decently and being a good person, and it makes it entertaining somehow, which is amazing. So I'm going to give it 5.
The only reason I wouldn't give it a 5 is because it's not overtly religious and it's not dealing with cosmic. But I again, how do we treat people and how do we view people and what are assumptions that we make about people? It's complete love your neighbor kind of film. And those are the people who come off the best in the film are the ones who are willing to see people for who they are.
I have this ongoing sort of thing where I don't want to give it 5 unless there is an explicit connection to Christ or Christianity. And that was missing from this movie. So I'm going to give it 4 apricots. But once again, this is a deeply moral movie. And I saw it through the lens of Mrs. Harris is the Christ figure, not in the sense that she redeems other people, but just that I feel that if everybody looked through Christ's eyes to see everybody else, they would view the world the way Mrs. Harris does. And I found that deeply moving. But it's not explicitly Christian, so 4 apricots for me.
All right, I'm going to pull in another scripture. If all people could be like unto Mrs. Harris, the foundations of hell would be shaken forever. So
absolutely.
There you go.
That could be the subtitle for our episode.
Could be. We'll see what comes up. You can follow my writing and book reviews at lizbusby.com. Carl, where can people find you?
I'm still trying to make Threads go. I'm on Threads at Carl Cranny if you'd like to come try to help this struggling social media network get off the ground.
There you go. And Kirsten, where can people find you?
You can find me on the platform formerly known as Twitter at BYU_librarian.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you enjoyed this episode, share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice or on YouTube. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode via email, social media, or our website. And we love hearing from our listeners. Carl, can you tell us what we'll be discussing in our next episode?
All right. I am excited. Next time, we will have a theme episode, and we're going to be discussing AI in movies. That's artificial intelligence. This is an idea I had a few months ago, just as ChatGPT was coming out and Midjourney and all these sorts of things were suddenly exploding. And I was like, oh, hey, the future is kind of here. But as all of these things have advanced, even in the last couple of weeks, this just feels like a really timely sort of conversation to have, because it turns out science fiction and fantasy writers and authors and directors and script writers and actors have been dealing with these sorts of issues for a while. And I look forward to seeing where our conversation goes and some of the themes that they have already addressed that are going to be here and present in our lives faster or sooner than you think, or in some cases are already here.
Indeed. All right, this has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. We'll see you next time.